I'd like to open this meeting of the Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2050. Jennifer.
House Bill 2050 extends the time to establish a caregiver relationship between a juvenile and an unrelated foster parent from 6 to 12 months.
Okay, Kevin George.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2050, and I want to provide some information to you. So there's written testimony that I will go through, not in full detail, as you, I assume, you'll be able to read all that information anyway, but to give you the highlights. So intervener status is a state law that allows people to intervene in juvenile court cases. And if they are requesting of the court, they file a motion to the court to say, I would like to become an intervener in this case. And that's somebody in addition to the parents of the children, DHS, any other attorneys that might be in there, or ACASA, a child court-appointed special advocate. And so foster parents or other people may actually ask the court to become an intervener. And so that's really kind of the context of what this is, and allows them to attend hearings, get information, and be a party on those cases. So House Bill 2050 changes the distance between a foster parent, a non-related foster parent. This is not about related foster parents, because we have foster parents that are both relatives and non-relatives. So it merely takes those that are non-related and moves it to 12 months before they can actually file a motion with the court to ask for intervener status. This does not change the relative's ability to file at 6 months or earlier based on other conditions. A little history is, in Oregon, we have had this statute here for a number of years, a caregiver relationship, and that's how it's defined in statute. And over the last 15 to 20 years, it has gone from 18 months where a foster parent had to wait before they could file to 12 months to down to 6 months. And so in 2005, when it moved down to 6 months, the last 3 to 4 years, what we've been starting to see is at times you have a non-related foster parent, in essence, competing with a relative for a grandchild, because they both have equal standing within 6 months. And so this bill merely asks that foster parents have a 12-month waiting period where relatives are 6 months. This bill is coming forward to you because of some of those dynamics over the last couple of years, and also because in 2007, this legislative body passed Senate Bill 414, which was a very comprehensive child welfare bill, along with 9 other bills that came forward around child welfare. And it was promoted by Senator Cruz and Senator Brown at the time, and Representative Kriegler and Schaffler, where they brought a number of child welfare bills forward. And the theme that was throughout each and every one of those bills was preference for relatives, and that we need to have laws in Oregon and practice in Oregon that provides relative preference in any sort of child welfare decisions around placement and intervention. And so that's why this bill is coming forward. This one was not moved at that point in time, and we really discovered through the course of time we really need to move this to really separate and provide a preference for relatives. So Oregon at this point in time continues to work with relatives, continues to prioritize relatives for placements, and believe, and research shows, that preference for relatives really is the best long-term outcome for children. They do better within relative placements. If they can stay within the family structure, they will do better long-term. And that's why we want to continue to push forward on any sort of relative preference and align statute after statute after statute, along with department administrative rules and policies, to really provide that preference. Currently, we're in the process of working with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families and Casey Family Programs out of Seattle, which is a national child welfare foundation who provides evidence-based practice and best practices around the country, and really honing in on several initiatives, one specifically being on relatives and how to engage relatives, how to work with relatives, and how to have more children placed with relatives. So we've set a goal by 2011 to have 50% of our children placed with relative placements. We're at 30% now, so we have a margin to certainly improve on. We firmly believe that this collaboration will really move Oregon forward, but in order to do that, we need to be consistent with all of our statutes and policies in order to get there along the way. So House Bill 2050 supports the legislative intention that started last session in 2007 and aligns more of those policies. And in your handout that I provided you, I tried to break down a matrix that in our hearing over on the other side of the building got really confusing. So the matrix was one to try to simplify and to say, look, here are the statutes that changed last session, and this is how House Bill 2050 supports all those changes that were made last time. It's important, though, is that we talk about this. This is that foster parents in Oregon, both relative and non-related foster parents, provide continued support and care to some of Oregon's most vulnerable children in the state, and their work cannot go without enough acknowledgement about their support to kids and their involvement within the court process. They have the ability, as being a foster parent, to be notified of all court hearings and to participate in court hearings and be heard. So the judge, she or he, must stop and ask them what they believe is going on with the child and the case plan. So they have that opportunity at that point in time. And there are some other statutes that give them increased rights in other areas, but this one focuses specifically on the intervention. So I'd ask that this bill move forward in support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah, just for the committee's information, number one, the Casey grant I'm very excited about, and it's eight pilot counties, and one of the things they're going to be doing is hopefully creating a better system for relative search. So, because we know that if we have the right people engaged at the earliest possible moment, the outcomes are going to be better. This bill actually came out of our interim foster care work group. We make adjustments to try to expedite a lot of things, and we did go from 18 to 12 to 6, and then after the last couple of years, we kind of said, "Oops, shouldn't have done that." So we decided to go back to 12. Representative Tomei was gracious enough to introduce this as a committee bill on the House side, but this was the one bill recommendation out of the interim foster care work group. So, Senator Berger.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your presentation this morning. I guess I'm a little disturbed that when you just say that relative, I want to make a few comments and then I have a question for you. I'd like to hear acceptable relative, qualified relative, loving relative, willing relative. I mean, we all have family members we might not want to live with. And so it really concerns me that, and I had a case in my district, if you remember, a very high-profile case with Gabriel. And the grandmother in Mexico, who did not know the child at all, had very strong standing with Gabriel over two very loving people who knew him and had taken care of him. So those are my comments. And I guess that my question is, who was opposed to this bill?
Chair Cruz, Senator Berger, two things. One is, The law that's being changed is a file to the court, so the court is still the one with judicial discretion on which relatives are in and which ones are not. So it's still a judicial decision. They just have the ability to file. They don't have the ability to become a party until the judge rules on what he or she believes is what's important. So there's that caveat to that. When you say opposed to the bill, mm-hmm. Are you meaning from the House side? Are you meaning from the previous committee?
During the hearing, somebody has opposed the bill, and I'm just, on what grounds was their opposition to this bill?
Okay. Yes, Senator Berger, on the other side of the building, the committee actually heard from Juvenile Rights Project and from the Oregon Foster Parent Association, who both raised some concerns around really dividing the line between foster parents and non-foster parents. What we did at that point in time was that at that point in time it was also very confusing around, are we trying to change administrative rule or statute? And so the hearing itself, from my perspective, was very confusing. I provided, quite honestly, too much information as to how this impacts treatment, this impacts all these other bills and laws out there, which is why we honed down to say, look, This directly impacts about four or five different statutes that were changed last session. And so from that point in time, the Juvenile Rights Project, Brian Baker specifically, Don Darna from the Oregon Foster Parent Association, and myself, we all just kind of came up with a, you know, the reality is we have differing opinions on this. We may have some issues to deal with on rules, but that's not the statute at this point in time. And so it wasn't a very compelling argument from my side or their side about this. This was trying to really hone in on saying, look, we need consistency within statute. If the direction the legislature really is to say there needs to be a preference relatives, then we need to have that in the child welfare laws that it attaches to.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I guess my comment, and this is not meant to you individually, but as a legislator, I am very concerned that we still don't have the child welfare situation good. And so I don't know what it's going to take, but we stay in the newspaper and we stay on my email list from constituents, and so at some point we really need to get a hold on it for our children.
Senator Virgil, let me respond to that, because I think it was last week, I think, we had the first meeting of the newly configured foster care work group. Senator Brown has been replaced by Senator Schrader, who brings a very interesting perspective to the process as a former county commissioner. And this meeting was convened by Judge Brewer to look at the beginning, some of the legal issues involved. But we're looking at the whole system at this point in time and saying, kind of the point we're going, and it's going to be a two-year project for us, is to notice all of the problems we have had in a system that is bound to have problems just because of the issues we're dealing with. But where we're starting is, let's assume nothing exists, and if we build a system, what would it look like? And so that's kind of the approach we are going to take. But that really doesn't impact this bill. That's a whole different discussion, and it's a relevant discussion that needs to go forward. But that doesn't impact this bill. So, Senator Morris Anderson.
I have a situation where he isn't my constituent. He's a blue-collar laborer, single grandfather in his late 40s or early 50s. He's done work for me. And his daughter was very involved in drugs, and a child was given up to foster care. And his extreme frustration, because he is single and a laborer, his rights to visit his granddaughter, it had to be supervised. And I didn't know where to go, because I did not know the history. But it was 2 years difference when I had him working on some projects for me, and when he came back with the same, you know, desire to be able to have more time with his granddaughter. So in situations like that, where it was the child was put into non-relative foster care, I think he knew he could not care for the child, or I think he felt that he would never ever be able to get the rights to care because of his living situation. Can you comment on that aspect?
Certainly, Chair Cruz and Senator Mona Sanderson, those are always, you know, extremely difficult decisions, no matter where you are in the continuum of the child welfare system, whether you're a legislature or whether you're a caseworker trying to make those decisions, is very challenging. I would say, though, that there are a number of venues or avenues on how to obtain visitation, whether it's supervised or not. Generally, if there's a supervised visit, there's some reasons for that, given certainly, you know, our resources and lack thereof at times with staffing, we're only going to be supervising visits if we really need to, and that children actually can do well with unsupervised visits at the time, but it's usually a decision point that you're making as to why it's being supervised. So I can't really comment on as to what the thinking was behind that. What I can say, though, is that through the work of Senator Cruz and his colleagues, I don't like to refer to as the Gang of Four, but his colleagues from last session.
It was.
Added into that same statute things around court order visitation. So the court can order some visitation plans at that point in time. They have to review the visitation plans, which prior to then they really didn't have some of that responsibility. So there is some change from last time, as well as within the same statute area, there is an area for relatives to go in and ask for limited participation, which is yet another right to go into court and say, I may not have the ability to be an intervener, but I want limited participation. And they can ask the court to do that, and the court may grant them, yes, you are a limited participant in this case merely for the purposes of visitation or merely for the purposes of attending hearings. So there is some avenues to get there for a relative.
I think I may follow up on this case because here's a person that doesn't have money to go through a legal system, let alone figure out what you just explained, and so those are the types of issues that, you know, aren't really brought to our attention because the system is so cumbersome in not allowing some very legitimate contacts between, say, grandfathers and grandmothers with those who are in non-foster care. So.
Chair Cruz, Senator Mona Anderson, I would say from a perspective of somebody who is obviously grayed over the years in working in child welfare, as we become more legalistic in this system, the more complicated it's got.
Yes.
To where when back in the day when a social worker was a social worker and you were able to work with families and this and that, when we spent a lot of time in court preparing legal documents, that kind of work now, that's where, my humble opinion, we start missing the value of the social worker in some of this work. I do know that the committee that Senator Cruz is referring to is one of those that has trying to, hopefully will try to look at some of these things holistically and not as an individual change, because I think over the last, you know, 8 to 9 years that I've been more involved with the legislative process and knowing bills that are changing, we've changed this bill and then changed this one and this one and not stopped until really last session to start saying, let's holistically look at this system and how do we change these collectively so we have that consistent theme of saying, yes, there is a preference for relatives, and so within that we need to do this. Aside from that, then, that's where my job comes in to say, now I need to take these laws and, quite frankly, turn them into English so the layperson on the streets can read this and understand. If I'm a grandparent, here's some information, here's a tool. You know, we're working on a pamphlet right now that would say, here's your rights as grandparents of children coming into foster care, so we can hand those out to grandparents through some of the relative search and things so they start understanding, yes, I know I can do this piece here without having to get an attorney to go to court to get that information. So I think we're on the right track, but those points are certainly valid.
Just one more comment, yeah. I think it's extremely important since we have so many low-income. I think those who have decent jobs and can pay for it and are educated in a sense to be able to manipulate through the paperwork, I think we really need to be sensitive to the needs who maybe only have an eighth grade education yet are as loving and as concerned about the welfare of their child as someone who has maybe the ability to be able to work the system.
I would agree.
Yeah, just say all valid points, and we are taking a more holistic view of this. But and clearly, in this bill, our preference for relative placement does not change. But there's also the fact that there is not always good relative placement. And so from my perspective, the second best option is somebody with a caregiver relationship so the child can stay in the community in familiar surroundings and not have to be placed in a foster home in another town or something like that. So the closer we can keep the kids to the world they know, the better off those kids are. And so the whole purpose of this is when we don't have a good foster place or relative placement, to at least give us the time to see, to make sure that if we have a good caregiver option, that we have fully vetted that to make sure it's an appropriate placement, which is all this all this does is extend the time frame to allow that to happen. Like I said, I think we shortened the time frame too short. We realized that we had done that, and so we're saying, oops, we screwed up. Let's go back to something that's more appropriate.
And just one other, which is not relevant to the bill, because I definitely see the merits of the bill, regarding relatives who really want to be caregivers because it'll provide an income.
Chair Morissette and Cruz and Senator Mona Sanderson, provide an income from the state for them. And I would say, yes, that comes up from time to time. The reality is when we get down to really talking about dollars and cents, we are reimbursing relatives or foster parents really on average of $13 to $14 a day for the care. So as folks hear about what we pay folks to do that, the reality is I have two teen boys in my household, and I know they can eat $14 worth of food by noon. So it's really not an income-generating proposition for the most part. It's really to provide some support and some support there. And it certainly helps folks, absolutely. In fact, the legislature actually passed a bill last session that allowed us to actually help some of the relatives who otherwise weren't being helped before. So, again, it's that consistent theme through the thing around how do we provide that preference to relatives, and this is yet one more way we're demonstrating there is a preference for relatives in the state.
Yeah, that was one of the bills we passed last session was because there were a lot of instances where an aunt or uncle would love to take the kid, but they had kids of their own, and we decided a financial burden, even though it's a small stipend, should not deter them from being able to take care of their own kin. So that was one of the nine bills we passed last session. So, any other questions?
The chair is back.
No, that's. I still have the gavel. I'm not going to give it back. Yeah, thank you very much. If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2050, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2050. Mr. Chair, would you like to make a motion? This is fun. I'm enjoying this.
Mr. Chair, I move 2050 to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
And Senator Morissette has moved House Bill 2050 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Aye.
Senator Burton.
Excused.
Senator Telfer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
Aye.
House Bill 2050, having received the required majority, is passed, and I will carry it. And I, on the record, want to give my thanks to Representative Tomei for introducing this for us and dealing with the confusion on that side of the building. And with that, Mr. Chair, here's your gavel.
I also want to thank Chair Tomei for hearing the Phyllis Beck Memorial Bill this morning. I was
you
there.
You think they're going to pass it?
They passed it.
Okay, good.
And Representative Boone is going to carry it the floor because she has a special interest in hepatitis C. So, okay, with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2581.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2581 transfers administration of the Rural Health Services Program from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to the Office of Rural Health. It redefines the qualifying practice site to reference the Federal Rural Health Clinics Act of 1977.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Scott Ekblad and Doug Barber are going to present. Scott, would you like to start?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2581, which would move the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program from its current home at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to the Office of Rural Health. For those of you on this committee a little less familiar with the Office of Rural Health, although I don't know if there are any up there that aren't, the Office of Rural Health was actually began as a state agency in 1979 and was moved to OHSU in 1989. And so while we still have some statutorily mandated duties, we are no longer a state agency. We're now a statewide community service of OHSU, which is a public corporation. This distinction does play a part in this bill. So, the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program was created by the legislature in 1989 and placed at the Student Assistance Commission. Now, at the time, a program like this was not a huge stretch for the Student Assistance Commission. They had a lot of similar loan programs, and they even had a collections department. However, today, the Student Assistance Commission is really unlike anything else. Excuse me, the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program is really unlike anything else that the Student Assistance Commission does. Represents a very tiny program within that large agency, and is correspondingly a low priority for them. The funding level for this program began at $400,000 per biennium, so $200,000 per year we're able to use for awards, and it remains at that level to this day. So it really is a very, very small piece of their organization. This allows us to give loan repayment to about half a dozen people each year. In fact, this past award cycle, which just happened in January, we were able to give loan repayment to four people, and the program covers five different professions, so we weren't even able to give loan repayment to someone representing at least one of the professions. Past attempts to increase funding for the program have really been non-starters when push comes to shove, and we've had several bad economic budget years in a row. This program just does not rise to the level of priority that it would need to in order to get increased state funding for the program. The Office of Rural Health, on the other hand, is an appropriate home for this program because we can dedicate the time and energy required to grow the program, to actively target it in a way that ensures the limited resources are going where they're needed most. We can solicit matching funds to create a public-private partnership as it was originally envisioned, and incorporate it into our existing provider recruitment service. In fact, I have approached some private foundations for funding for this program, and there's quite a bit of hesitance in giving grant money to a state agency's program. It's not the case with every foundation, but I have encountered that. No one needs to tell this committee
excuse
about healthcare.
Me. Yes, excuse sir. Me. Do you have an attached 501c3? Apparently you don't.
An attached? Do,
well, I mean, they will give... Foundations will give money to a 501c3, usually not a
yes,
state
they
program.
Yes, they would, Chair Moore said, they would grant money to the Office of Rural Health, but Oregon Student Assistance Commission is a state agency.
Oh, so, I see. Yeah. Okay.
No one needs to tell this committee about the healthcare workforce shortage in this state and in the nation as a whole. But I will mention that in addition to a shortage, there is also a maldistribution in the state. And just as an example, there's a physician for every 327 people in urban Oregon and one physician for every 819 rural Oregonians. So the Rural Health Services State Loan Repayment Program was created to benefit rural Oregon and to address that maldistribution. Eligible professionals for the program are physicians, primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, dentists, and pharmacists. Obligated service for physicians and pharmacists is 3 years, and dentists as well. And for nurse practitioners and PAs, it's a minimum obligation of 2 years. Data that we have collected for this program shows that well over half of the people who have received loan repayment through this program stay beyond their minimum period of obligated service, but many also stay beyond all years of service. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission has done an excellent job of initiating and implementing this program. The Oregon Office of Rural Health would like to take it to the next level, to grow it, to target it, and to make it work for more rural communities. And I'll just add that when this bill was being heard over on the House side, The executive director of Oregon Student Assistance Commission came to testify in support of the bill, and he brought up a good point. The bill as it's currently written, the effective date would be January. The awards are typically given out in December or January, and so I would like to suggest that an emergency clause be placed on this bill so that the effective date would be July 1. Our office would have time to gear up and be ready to make awards in December or January. So with that, I thank you very much for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions?
Yeah.
Yes, go
ahead. So at least in, under OHSU, you would have the opportunity to be able to take grants and donations to the loan repayment program or not?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's true. We could, and in fact, anything that we were able to raise, whether it's through fundraising events or foundations or what have you, would actually go through the OHSU Foundation.
Thank you.
Are you in danger of losing some of the existing funding?
Chair Morissette, as a matter of fact, there is a companion program to this for rural nursing. And we were just notified by the Student Assistance Commission that they are putting on hold or not holding the awards cycle for that program as was scheduled this year due to threat of budget cuts.
Sure.
But that's not true, this program.
I haven't heard the same thing for this program, but then they aren't scheduled to make awards in December.
Yeah, okay.
Another reason to suggest an emergency clause.
Good idea. Okay. Thank you. Doug.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians in strong support of House Bill 2581. We've been working closely with Scott on this, both to try to get the program moved to his shop, but also to increase the funding for the program. There was a companion bill on the House side that we introduced that would have increased the appropriation for this bill from $400,000 for the biennium, which is what it has been, up to $3 million. And it did not move out of the House committee given the budget difficulties. But as you know, given the work that you and others have been doing on health care reform, if we are going to increase the number of people with insurance in this state, in order to provide them access, we're also going to have to increase the number of physicians, particularly primary care physicians. And we've seen what happens when that's not the case in Massachusetts. You know, they've done a pretty good job of getting more people insured in Massachusetts, and I've seen a series of stories about how now people get their insurance and they call their doctor to set up and get a physical. And the physician's office says, yeah, sure, we're happy to schedule that for you. We're scheduling between 14 and 16 months out. So, you know, would you like one in the summer of 2010? So the problems in rural Massachusetts are much worse than they are in urban Massachusetts. In Oregon, we will see the same kind of process, where, as Scott said, the ratio of physicians is much lower in the rural areas. We need these kinds of programs to attract physicians. The students who are part of the Academy of Family Physicians repeatedly talk about the $175,000, $200,000 debt that they have when they're finishing up their schooling, and the prospect of going into family medicine a difficult choice, because family medicine does not pay as well as the specialties, and then to make the choice of going into family medicine in a rural community means your income is going to be even that much lower. So programs like this loan repayment program are a small incentive that can really help those physicians make that choice and really help the rural communities. So we strongly ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? This did not need a fiscal. This didn't go to Ways and Means. So
there was a initially it had a referral to Ways and Means that was rescinded on the House side.
The fiscal statement has had.
Oh, okay. Okay, but it's an existing program and it's in the budget, correct?
No.
So far. Well, so just transferring the money to the other.
Well, the money is being transferred, but I mean, this is not new money.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Morissette, as I understand it, the only reason that I've been able to find for the referral is that transfer from a state agency to OHSU.
It looks to me when I read the fiscal that there would be a $1,495,373 amount. That evidently would be needed to make this transfer, which seems like a lot of money.
Yeah. Okay. So this bill.
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, I believe the way the program works is when they make an award to a physician or a dentist, they encumber the funds for the full term of that award. So if it's a $100,000 over 5 years, they encumber that $100,000. It sits in their account waiting to be dispersed over that period of time. So the $1,000,004 that you're talking about is money that has already been awarded to rural health providers and is sitting in the account waiting to be dispersed over the coming years.
Basically, it says that this amount does reflect the Rural Health Services Program for the 2009-11 budget, budgeted beginning balance, plus budgeted interest income, plus 18 months of the 2009-11 general fund essential budget level. So it is a ways and means referral.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't have a work session scheduled, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 31.
2581.
Okay, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2135.
House Bill
2185. Have to get used to the House Bill 2185. Okay, do we have Dr. Katrina Hedberg, David Sean Miller, and David Rubinoff.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2135 requires rental agreements to indicate whether smoking is prohibited on the rental property, allowed or allowed only in specific areas on the property. Exempts owner-occupied mobile homes and houseboats from the rental agreement requirement and specifies the requirement to be included in the rental agreement and smoke detection statutes.
Okay.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Department of Human Services. And I'm here in support of House Bill 2135A, which requires landlords to disclose the smoking status of rental property as a standard part of the rental agreement. Exposure to secondhand smoke is a serious health problem. In Oregon, we estimate that there's 800 deaths each year related to secondhand smoke. The Surgeon General says that there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. It can have many of the same health effects that direct smoking has for people who live in that environment, including heart disease, respiratory disease, cancers, among others. But even small amounts of secondhand smoke can trigger an asthma attack in individuals who have asthma. Multi-unit housing is one of the few indoor places in Oregon where non-smokers might be inadvertently exposed to secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke can flow through light fixtures, crawl spaces, in and out of doorways, through windows. So if one person is smoking in one unit, of course it can go out through the window in the one and potentially into a unit next door. And often the people who rent houses are the ones who are most vulnerable to the negative effects of smoking, including elderly, people with chronic health conditions, disabilities, lower income levels. And we know that people who have lower income levels, that's also associated with the prevalence of asthma. So, if you will, the people who might be most severely impacted by secondhand smoke are also the ones who are living in these rental units. We're working, of course, on a variety of levels to decrease this potential exposure. Many landlords have voluntarily adopted not only no smoking units, but no smoking grounds for all of their property in an effort to protect Oregonians. But landlords, this bill would only require landlords to inform potential renters that who are in multi-unit housing that they might be exposed to secondhand smoke, and thereby giving them the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to rent a unit in that particular housing complex or not. And we've also found from surveys that a lot of renters not only themselves would like to have this information, but many of them would choose to smoke in, to live in places that are smoke-free so that they are not inadvertently exposed to secondhand smoke. And in fact, a number of smokers who themselves choose not to smoke indoors and would prefer to live in housing that is smoke-free. So in summary, the Public Health Division, we support passage of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Yes.
I think it should be written in the contract. I have some rentals, and make sure that, and then actually the rental association that I'm a member of, the rental housing association that I'm a member of, has forms that we actually give to the renters to state that they realize the conditions of where they can smoke and where they cannot smoke, yeah. As well as having placards. I think maybe you might be talking to that.
Okay. Are you talking about attached units, duplexes?
Duplexes.
Yeah, okay. Is it less likely to occur in an unattached? I guess that if the owner does not want the smoke permeating whatever, they would have a non-smoking in a non-attached unit. Okay. The carpets, the drapes, and so on.
Yes, Chair Morissette, that's correct. This bill really is talking about informing renters about the status of the particular property.
Now, there are some exemptions in this bill, which you will be speaking to. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is David Rubinow, and I'm a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation. Today, I'm representing the foundation, as well as the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, which is a coalition of organizations dedicated to advocating for programs and policies that will decrease the toll of tobacco use in Oregon. Here to voice our support for House Bill 2135A, which would require landlords to include their smoking policy in their rental agreement. I have also submitted copies of this testimony as well as a fact sheet, which actually shows the broad-based support of organizations supporting this bill. The mission of the Northwest Health Foundation is to advance, support, and promote the health of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. Since our inception in 1997, the Northwest Health Foundation has been investing in a wide variety of programs and projects that have improved the health of the people in our region. Many of the organizations we support address the root causes of health disparities through community-driven upstream solutions in order to address the leading causes of death and diseases such as obesity, diabetes, and illnesses connected with tobacco use. The Northwest Health Foundation is also actively engaged in advocating for sound policies that protect the community's health, and it is in this context that I'm speaking to you today. The foundation has been pleased to invest in the Portland Metro Area Smoke-Free Housing Project through a three-year grant to the American Lung Association of Oregon. This outstanding project has worked with the business community to provide resources and technical assistance, like trainings, to property owners and managers as they make the transition to non-smoking leases, no smoking leases. The project has been a true model of a public-private nonprofit partnership and has set the pace nationally for work with the housing sector to pass no-smoking policies that protect property owners' assets while providing a healthy and much sought-after amenity to renters, and that is smoke-free living.
House Bill 2135A represents another opportunity for Oregon to lead the way nationally on smoke-free living. Requiring smoking policies to be disclosed in the rental agreement not only creates an incentive for property owners to adopt a no-smoking rule, it also gives renters a great opportunity to find housing that will meet their needs. We feel that this is a win-win situation that is good for business and good for the public's health, and that has the strong support of the health sector, renters' advocates, and also the rental housing industry. We are pleased to support House Bill 2135A, and we'd be happy to answer any questions about our investment in this project. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? It's interesting because I, too, own two duplexes. One of them, one duplex, it's attached, and the others are two separate buildings, and I have not been aware of this program. And I work through a property manager. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that they are aware of it in Eugene Springfield. And I will question that. And I have never had a complaint from any of the tenants about smoking. So I don't know if it's an issue. But my, as a former smoker, I have a reaction to secondhand smoke. I can feel it, which is interesting. So I'm sensitized to it. So anyway, I'm learning something today, so I appreciate your being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association, which represents nearly 5,000 landlords, property managers statewide. Also want to convey that the Metro Multifamily Housing Association, which is around 150,000 rental units statewide, both organizations support House Bill 2135. And I think to get just straight to the question that Senator Montes Anderson brought up is, for us, we believe more and more landlords are actually moving towards smoke-free housing. And so I would suspect that through Senator Morissette, your property manager, they may be doing that currently on some of their properties just to restrict the liability from the landlord's perspective or the property manager's perspective, not only in fire danger, but also disputes between tenants who may not be aware of the secondhand smoke issue, as they may not have the choice of, because it was not on the rental agreement.
Right.
We have been promoting this for some time to include this on the rental agreement, as Senator Montes Anderson suggested. As a member of our association, she's legal, and under this law, she would be legal, and she's currently doing it now.
I'm illegal.
And hopefully you're legal, but actually, by having it in the rental agreement and by passing this bill, this backs up what we're trying to promote to landlords now. And so having this in the law, I think, is important to back up what we're currently trying to get all landlords to do, and that's include this in the rental agreement. I'll just close in saying that on the House side, we did make a few modifications, amendments to the bill, and I appreciate the work with the department on this. On lines 13 and 14, you see that this does not apply to rental agreements subject to ORS 9505 to 9840 for a space in a facility defined in ORS Chapter 90. That particular exemption distinguishes between the difference of a the typical landlord-tenant dwelling, apartment complexes, duplexes, even houses, versus a manufactured housing park facility or a marine park facility where you actually rent the space and the tenant actually owns either the manufactured home or a boat in a marina, those things. So it distinguishes between the difference in that scenario, where I think the landlord would not probably be able to restrict their ability to smoke in their own property that they own. And so that is the exemption that we put in on the House side. But we would urge the committee to move this bill forward. I think it's a good bill, not only for landlords but for tenants, and for the public health advocates as well. And so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Other questions, comments? We're not having a work session, but there's no frizz, right?
There's no revenue or fiscal impact, right? Correct.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it be possible for the committee administrator to put possible work sessions so that some
of
these...
Yeah, I was going to... Yeah, because some of these we could move.
We were, when we were scheduling, we were up to our eyeballs in Senate bills, and so we just to schedule these because we hadn't had a chance to look at them yet, so...
Okay, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2138. And Mary Gear, Jack Caldwell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2138 updates the language and definitions related to continuing care retirement communities. It provides for increased disclosure of operating expenses, including fees, financial status, and Medicare and Medicaid provider status. It provides for the rights of residents in a continuing care community, including establishment of a resident council and a resident representative to the community governing board. It eliminates entrance fees from the definition of open bed long-term care facility and eliminates the requirement that changes to residential disclosure statements be disclosed to the Department of Human Services prior to release to residents. It requires providers amending an annual disclosure statement file all new materials with CHS.
Okay. Mary.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care and the Department of Human Services Seniors and People with Disabilities Division.
Yeah.
I'm very pleased to be here this morning to testify in support of House Bill 2138. This is a bill that the department, that the governor requested on behalf of the department. Continuing Care Retirement Communities, or CCRCs, are the campus-type long-term care arrangements that you may be familiar with. There might be licensed facilities on that campus, an assisted living or a nursing facility. Oftentimes, the CCRCs will provide everything from independent living to skilled nursing care on the same campus with a buy-in and often a monthly payment that, folks will make. The department is responsible for not only licensing what might be individual facilities on the campus, like an assisted living or a nursing home, but also registering the CCRC as a whole. And there is statute that gives the department the authority and sets some guidance for CCRCs. Last session, there was a bill introduced that did not pass that would have increased consumer protections in CCRCs, and it was the legislature's direction to the department to reconvene an advisory council on continuing care retirement communities that had been dormant for quite some time. So we reinvigorated that work, and that advisory council worked extremely hard and essentially took apart the entire statute and rewrote sections significantly in order to increase the consumer protections in several areas. This advisory council did extraordinary work, and the result is what you have before you in this bill. There's some specific things in, terms of changes that I just did want to point out to you. It strengthens the disclosure statements that a CCRC has to make to folks who are buying into the CCRC so that people understand what they're buying into and can make informed decisions. It expands the department's ability to revoke a registration if a CCRC is not abiding by the statutory and rule requirements. And it also creates a Bill of Rights for folks who buy into and who live in a continuing care retirement community. With the Dash 1 amendments on the House side, we made a couple of technical changes. There is an engrossed bill, and we're in support of the amendments as well as the what's captured in the engrossed bill. I just want to point out that there is a lot of support for this bill, and we were very pleased to see it pass out of the House with a unanimous vote. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Caldwell.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Jack Caldwell, and I am a a pioneer resident. Sometimes we refer to ourselves as the inmates, although it upsets people like our friend Scott Ferguson back here, who's the administrator. My colleague back here is Kim Allison, who has been very active at this, and he's also a resident at Mary's Woods. And he did a lot of work on getting this put together as well, although neither of us are members of the Advisory Council. Bill Campbell, who is, was unable to be here today. This is, as Ms. Geer said, a consumer protection bill. And what it does, it improves the statute by bringing the disclosure requirements up to date. And the statute was set up when CCRCs were in their infancy in Oregon, and naturally people have learned a few things. But a person who invests $3,000 in a mutual fund, as you probably noticed, you get more information than you ever want to read, and you keep getting it from the mutual fund all the time, and it's so thick. But it's there. You're being told about it, and if you don't read it and there's a problem, it's your fault. But a person can invest $300,000 or more as an entry fee into a continuing care retirement community, and under the current statute, you get very little disclosure, and you get almost no continuing disclosure. And I talk about this as an investment very advisedly, because an example is Mary's Woods. Excuse me. The development cost was about $90 million, and $60 million of that came from residents' entry fees. Now, those are refundable on death or departure, partially refundable, but nevertheless, they're investors, and we are the investors. This bill is a culmination of an effort that started clear back in the 2005 legislature, and in the last session, the bill, as Ms. Geer mentioned, was put in, and the Advisory Council was reconstituted, which is a very good thing. As I've said in my written material, this isn't perfect, but it's a great improvement over what we've had. And I was as amazed as anybody that it passed unanimously in the House, and pleased, of course. The push to do something started at Mary's Woods, but we think it's based on it's a benefit to the whole state. We found other communities had some of the problems we'd experienced at Mary's Woods, but we had seemed to have all the problems. We had a group of us decide we needed to come to the legislature, and we started working on that. We were blessed with the leadership and wise counsel, of Senator Mark Hatfield, who had to leave us and move south to warmer climes, but he was a very strong helper in getting us going. And in a letter to Speaker Minnis, which I quote in that testimony, he wrote that the actions of management in a community such as this affect not only our finances, but our future care and our entire lives. And this is very true. When most people, I might say, had to sell your house where you've lived and take that investment and put it into an entry fee. Now, there are a few fortunate people who didn't have to do that, but a majority did. So we think that there's transparency in the decision that Senator Hatfield asked, and we're glad to answer questions. We thank you for this opportunity and urge your support. Now, Kim Allison here, who is a former California lawyer, did a lot of work in getting the California law on which many of the provisions of this bill came from that, and it's been operating and working for a long time. I'm willing to answer any questions, and if you have any questions concerning where this came from, some of those ideas, Kim would be glad to answer those as well.
Questions? Did you have a question?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm not familiar with how it works. So you put a fee up front to the continuing care, and then what kind of fees do you have to pay once you start living there?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, the typical arrangement we find at Mary's Woods and many others, there's a new one going up in Portland called the Mirabelle down on the South Waterfront, and it's the same way. You pay an entry fee, Now that buys your right to live there the rest of your life and to have access to the continuing care, that is, from independent living to assisted living to a nursing home. And they don't provide a mortuary, but maybe they'll start doing that. That gets you in there, and you own the right to be there. But the place has to operate. So typically then the residents' fees monthly are not rent. They are in that type of an arrangement. They are the cost of operation based on the contract and based on audits and evaluation. And those can be somewhat contentious maybe or maybe not, but the point is that it's to be based on the operating costs.
Thank you.
The fee is $10,000 or more?
$10,000.
Well, wait a minute.
Chair Morissette, the entry fee?
Yeah.
The entry fee, $10,000 wouldn't touch an entry fee.
Well,
the entry fee, for example, entry fees at Mary's Woods.
An excessive $10,000, it says in the bill.
Yes, in the bill. That's if they are, but I don't think there are any that are even anywhere that low. The entry fees at Mary's Woods are minimum to entry fee for, say, a one-bedroom apartment would be probably $180,000. I was asking Mr. Ferguson, who's on the advisory committee and who is here, about what he'd heard about the new one, and he said it's up in the million-dollar level, some of those.
And you say that it's in the Pearl District, right?
No,
I'm kidding.
It's not in the Pearl District. It's in the
South comparable, though.
Yeah, it's South Waterfront. You know, South Waterfront, right near the bottom of the tram.
Oh, okay. Very nice.
And
I have a question about Senator Hatfield. He lived, when I talked to him one time about a house that he bought on the coast near Salisan, and whether or not it was on the spit. And he said, no, it wasn't on the spit.
Fortunately.
Yeah. But he did sell that then.
Chair Morissette, yes, Senator Hatfield and Mrs. Hatfield sold that house, and they moved to Mary's Woods as pioneer residents 8 years ago.
Oh.
And just had to leave this last year. His health is not good.
Yeah, right, okay.
He's a great guy, though.
He absolutely is, yes.
Senator, if I may?
Yes.
Speak to the buy-in. There are some CCRCs that work to keep the buy-in down lower so that it's more accessible to folks, but it is a considerable amount of money. And I just wanted to mention that when we register a CCRC, one of the things that we look at is that the CCRC has kept enough reserve in order to be able to pay back the buy-ins for folks who are leaving or who have passed on. So that's part of our regulatory control.
Now, is there one in the Medford area? Because we visited, I believe, a couple of years ago when I was in the house.
Chair Morissette, yes, Rogue Valley Manor.
Okay, and it is?
It's the largest one in the state, I believe.
Okay.
Right.
And they do have the assisted living, the independent living, assisted living, nursing home, and that continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. I'm familiar. We visited that site, a legislative committee in 2001, I believe.
If you hadn't lost your vice chair, he could tell you all about it, I'm sure.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. We have more testimony. Scott Ferguson. Ruth, would you come up, please? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Ferguson, you're part of management, so you're going to kind of set the record straight, are you?
I hope so. Oh. Yes. Depends on if the residents agree with me or not. So. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm the executive director of Capital Manor Retirement Community, which is located in West Salem. It's a continuing care retirement community that opened in 1963. And I'm also the chair of the State of Oregon Continuing Care Retirement Community Advisory Council.
Where are you at Whit Manor?
Capital Manor.
Oh, yes.
Across
yes.
the river. Right. When this bill or suggested bill came out of the legislature that we look at it, the committee was reconvened. It was we were a full committee. We were reconvened. I happened to be the lucky person who was the chairman of that committee. Well, we went into a little hiatus there and so came back as the chair. We spent 9 hours in a committee work session hearing testimony on all aspects of the bill. The gentleman from Murray's Woods were at most of that, and if they weren't, their representative was there. We also decided that since the original bill was written in 1990, that it needed to be updated, if nothing else, in language alone. So we looked at the original bill as well and combined it into the legislation that you see before you. It was a good work session. There was a lot of give and take, but I think the consensus of the committee dealt with all of the issues, and we strongly recommend that it be passed.
Questions? Yes, Senator Montanez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to give kudos to Capital Manor. My in-laws lived there for many years, Bob and Betty Anderson.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They are, so I had many dinners there, and they started out independent living and then moved into an apartment. So now I can understand that is actually called a continuing care community.
Right.
I wasn't sure about the definition. Thank you.
And what is your entry fee?
And you need to be careful when you're talking about CCRCs and entry fees because they're all a little different in terms of the program. So I'll give you a brief synopsis of how we classify them. The most beneficial in my mind to the resident is a type A or an inclusive contract where they pay an entry fee, and then when they move through the different levels of care, their monthly fees don't vary much. So if you're paying, you know, $2,500 a month and you go into a nursing home, you're paying $2,500 a month, which on the outside would cost you $8,000 to $10,000
right.
a month. And so our entry fees, and we're a type A, range from $65,000 for a studio to $225,000 for an 1,800 square foot home out and back. Ours are not refundable. After 50 months, they've amortized. And if you move out before 50 months, you get an amortized amount back. After 50 months, there's nothing that goes back. Then there's a type B contract, which is a modified contract, and they have a limited number of days in health care at the reduced fee. And I've seen the limited number of days be as small as 3 and as long as 21 days per year, not cumulative. And then you would pay a higher rate in health care. And entry fees don't always correlate to the cost of care, but they correlate more to where you live. Yeah, Portland has a higher cost of living, so you pay a higher entry fee. And those people who pay request a refundable entry fee, be it 50, 80, or 100%, pay appreciably more for that than they do in a type A that has non-refundable contracts.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ruth?
Good morning. My name is Ruth Gullius. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, representing mission-directed long-term care service providers, including CCRCs. There are continuing care retirement communities. Mm-hmm. There are 15 registered communities in the state. 11 of them are not-for-profit and members of our organization. I am here to support this bill. We are very pleased at the outcome and the process that was allowed to take place from 2007 and 2009 through the work of the advisory council, the many people that participated in testimony, the department and the committee, the House Committee on Human Services, that allowed that thorough discussion to take place on a variety of issues. And we think this bill that resulted from that really resulted in increased transparency and good information for consumers to make decisions when they are making the decision to move into a retirement community. And as Mr. Ferguson said, talking about the contracts, that really underscores the importance of the increased disclosure and information that are given to consumers up front, because contracts are evolving due to the desire of consumers that are moving into communities wanting to have more options in front of them. So we see those contracts evolving as we move through time. I would just like to mention, in closing, our organization has four resident programs that we hold for our membership throughout the year, and we are having one today to honor our volunteers within our retirement communities for all the work that they contribute to the greater good of the community, and which has certainly underscored the need for that more today than perhaps in times past. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Now, I know in the past there's been a waiting list at Capital Manor. I know my in-laws, in the 70s or 80s, I don't know when they put their name on the list, 10 or 15 years before they got in. Do you still have a waiting list at Capital Manor?
We have a waiting list, but the economy, the Salem economy, which is our market, has is very fiscally conservative, yeah. So people selling homes and having to deal with investment movement has slowed down. We typically run about 94-95%, but over the last 18 months that has dropped down to 85%.
Right.
But we're starting to see it pick back up again. And in Portland, they didn't experience that.
Hmm.
So it's a little more of a challenge for us here.
Well, we baby boomers are itching mushroom.
Yeah.
In two more years, we'll start being 65.
What kind of volunteers do you have? I'm interested in
the volunteers. It spans the continuum. We have volunteers that work within the greater community. They're working in the schools. They're working in parks.
Okay, so these are people who live there
who are volunteering
in the community.
Community.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're having a big event this afternoon to honor them.
Yeah. Okay. I was wondering if you had volunteers that come in and do the work. But you have volunteers that go out and do the
That's
work.
That's right.
They do a lot of work in, too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they have time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2138. And if there are no other business before the body, we will adjourn. Welcome.
Good timing, Senator.